the headlines, Russia says humanitarian corridors out of Kiev and four other Ukrainian cities are open to allow civilian evacuations from conflict zones. Fears are growing over an energy war between Russia and the West, and the U.S. pushes to ban Russian oil imports, and Moscow threatens to cut gas to Europe. And Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has launched a reconnaissance satellite and successfully put it into orbit. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Russia says it is observing a temporary ceasefire in several Ukrainian cities so that civilians can flee to safe areas. The Defense Ministry says Russian forces have paused the attacks and that humanitarian corridors are open out of the cities of Chernihiv, Sumy, Kharkiv, and Mariupol, as well as the capital Kiev, to let the civilians out. Earlier, Russian and Ukrainian envoys traded barbs at the Security Council over civilian evacuations. Ukraine's envoy said that Russia is violating earlier agreements on humanitarian corridors and has accused Moscow of shunning the evacuees. But the Russian envoy blamed Ukrainian nationalists for breaching the agreement on the evacuation process.
The radicals in Mariupol violated this agreement, as is clear from a radio conversation that was intercepted between two commanders of the Nationalist Battalion Azov, that is in Volnovakhi, those who were heading for the humanitarian life and limb to checkpoints to exit the Nazis. There's a great deal of video evidence of this.
The Russian envoy also accused Ukrainian nationalists of using civilians as human shields. In the meantime, the head of the UN Refugee Agency, Filippo Grandi, says the number of Ukrainian refugees has now reached 2 million people. On the battlefield, officials in the northeastern city of Sumy say that at least 21 civilians have lost their lives in a Russian airstrike. Also, President Zelensky of Ukraine has blasted Western countries for not fulfilling their pledges of military support, saying that Ukraine has been hearing those promises for 13 days. The UN has confirmed the deaths of around 400 civilians since the beginning of the offensive. Russia's military offensive against Ukraine and the ensuing Western sanctions are wreaking havoc on global markets and the global economy, with Moscow warning of unpredictable and catastrophic consequences. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the U.S. and European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. On Nord Stream 2 sanctions, Novak warned that Russia could cut gas supplies via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Germany, but it has not made such a decision yet. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high, amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs. Russia is the world's biggest wheat exporter. Together with Ukraine, it accounts for about 29% of global wheat exports. In stock markets, European shares fell to their lowest in a year, with Germany and Italy's benchmark index slipping into a so-called bear market. Iran sending a new military satellite into space, with the launch being described as successful. The announcement was made by the Aerospace Division of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The satellite, dubbed Nur 2, was launched out of a location in Shahrud Desert and placed into orbit some 500 kilometers above Earth. The IRGC says the satellite will be used for reconnaissance purposes. The IRGC's first space launch took place in April 2020, when it put Nur 1 satellite into orbit. The IRGC says Nur 1 is still active despite predictions of a one-year lifespan and continues to send signals. Iran's Assembly of Experts has held its second meeting this year. The biannual meeting reviewed the latest domestic and international developments. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has more.
Members of Iran's Assembly of Experts have held their second biannual meeting this year. That's the 9th official session of the current Assembly, which was elected in 2016.
Members of the Assembly of Experts convene twice a year to review the latest domestic and global issues. This time, Ebrahim Raisi, who's one of the Assembly's members, has participated as Iran's president.
Raisi was invited to highlight his administration's achievements and review the challenges it faces. During this session, Chairman of the Assembly of Experts, Ahmad Jannati, urged President Raisi to take practical steps to address the economic problems of Iranians and improve their livelihood.
We need to improve the livelihood of the less privileged strata. The Honorable President must take steps to make this happen. I hope other members of this cabinet follow suit and help the needy have a better life. This is the least we should do as a duty.
The Assembly of Experts was established in 1983, almost 4 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Its main task is to monitor the performance of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution. The experts should also elect a new leader in the event of the demise, resignation, or dismissal of the current leader.
The Assembly of Experts was the entity that elected Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei as the new leader after Imam Khomeini passed away in 1988. Not only does it supervise the performance of the leader, but it plays a crucial role in protecting the political establishment.
The Assembly of Experts is currently a body of 88 Islamic jurists. The entity consists of a leadership council and 6 committees. Members are elected by direct public vote for an 8-year term. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Happening this morning near the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces set about the routine demolition project, blowing up 2 more Palestinian homes. They used explosives to blow up the buildings that belonged to 2 Palestinian prisoners. The regime accuses the duo of killing an Israeli settler last year. Israel defends the practice of raising the family homes of attackers as a deterrent against future assaults, but rights groups have condemned the tactic as collective punishment. Last year, Israeli demolitions and the seizures of Palestinian structures across the occupied West Bank increased by 32%. Over 650 Palestinians were displaced as a result, more than half of them children. To get the details about the latest Israeli demolitions, we have reached out to our correspondent, Mona Kandil.
This demolition had taken place as a punitive measure or a collective punishment, because at the time those who carried out the operation, according to the Israelis, were arrested. However, their family homes had been destroyed in order to terrify and to send a clear message to other Palestinians not to follow the footsteps of Palestinian activists or Palestinian heroes, as they are described by Palestinians here in the occupied West Bank. Of course, the demolition was not easy, because Palestinians in Sidat al-Harithiya had clashed with Israeli forces, and many were wounded, according to our sources in Sidat al-Harithiya near Jenin.
Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip have held a protest to express solidarity with thousands of prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. The prisoners, including women and children, suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli prisons and are being denied basic rights. Ashraf Shannon has filed this report from Gaza.
Palestinians rallied on Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to drum up support for thousands of prisoners held in Israeli jails. Their solidarity action comes as around 450 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for their military court hearings for the third month in a row. Administrative detainees are denied due process, and their detention orders can be renewed for indefinite periods of time.
For the third month, the Palestinian administrative detainees are boycotting the Israeli military courts in order to protest the administrative detention. And now the Palestinian detainees need all kinds of support by the Palestinian community and the international community.
Palestinian prisoners are also subject to torture and psychological pressure by the Israeli prison authorities, including daily raids and solitary confinement. Currently, some 5,000 Palestinians are languishing inside Israeli jails, including minors and women.
The Israeli administration, they conducted series of attacks and aggression against prisoners, especially women. This gathering asking international community to put pressure to Israeli government in order to facilitate their rights and stop the aggression against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners regularly stage hunger strikes in protest against both the administrative detention policy and harsh detention conditions. Prisoners' advocacy groups have raised the alarm over the inhumane conditions inside Israeli jails.
Nowadays, the situation is going to explode inside Israeli prisons because of the Israeli measures that aimed to break the will of Palestinian detainees and to confiscate their rights.
Experts say Palestinian prisoners will continue to suffer inside Israeli jails as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Statistics by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The Yemeni army says it has shot down American-made reconnaissance aircraft over the northwestern province of Hajja. The army says the Scan Eagle drone was intercepted while carrying out a hostile operation. Yemeni armed forces frequently down American-made drones operated by Saudi Arabia and the UAE in the Yemeni airspace. Saudi Arabia and its allies have also recently intensified their airstrikes on Yemen. Their targets are mostly civilian infrastructure. Since 2015, the Saudi-led military campaign has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and has pushed millions towards poverty and famine. Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other major cities to denounce the tightening of the siege imposed on the impoverished nation by Saudi Arabia. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
Under the title, the detention of fuel ships is a U.S. decision and our choice is Yemen's hurricane operations, thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities to protest against the Saudi blockade imposed on the country.
The Yemeni people today came out to send a message to the world that they will not sit idle against this stifling siege backed by the U.S. and enforced under the supervision of the U.K. and members of the Saudi-led coalition. The siege is aimed to bring the Yemenis to their knees.
The protests are taking place amid the worst fuel crisis in Yemen since the beginning of the war, as Saudi Arabia keeps seizing Yemeni oil vessels despite obtaining entry permits by the UN. The long lines of people queuing at fuel stations in the capital Sana'a have reached 4 kilometers for the first time.
The Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni oil ships amid the silence of the United Nations. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council overlooks the violations of Saudi Arabia and its allies. We call on the international community to look at Yemen as it does with Ukraine and to stand by the millions of Yemenis who have been suffering for 7 years.
Recently, Saudi Arabia tightened the siege it imposes on Yemen and led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage. This has pushed the healthcare system to the verge of collapse, threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children.
Protesters hold the U.S. responsible for supporting the Saudi detention of oil ships, saying Washington is a major partner in the war against their country. They believe that the Yemeni army operations against Emirati and Saudi territories, especially those against Aramco facilities, are the only way to lift the siege. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Venezuela's president confirms that he has had a meeting with a high-level U.S. delegation visiting Caracas. What appears to be a U-turn in Washington's hostile policy towards the Latin American state. Nicolas Maduro said the meeting was, in his own words, respectful, cordial, and very diplomatic, and that the two sides agreed on an agenda for future discussions. Earlier, the White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, said the trip focused on a number of issues, including energy security. Media are quoting informed sources as saying that the talks focused on the easing of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela's oil. The U.S. is looking to use Venezuela's huge energy reserves amid the Western pressure campaign against Russia over its Ukraine offensive. Maduro has openly supported Russia's military move. Relations between Washington and Caracas have been sour. The White House cut off diplomatic relations in 2019. One teenager is killed and two others critically injured in a shooting outside of a high school in the U.S. state of Iowa. The incident happened at the state capital, Des Moines, shortly before 3 p.m. local time. Police statement says the gunfire appears to have come from a passing vehicle. Three potential suspects have been detained, but no charges have been filed. Mass killings involving firearms are common in the U.S., with the number of victims on the rise. Over 80 mass shootings have already been recorded this year, with the total number of gun violence deaths standing at nearly 8,000. The majority of Americans favor greater gun controls, however, lax laws and the right to bear arms have hampered efforts to clamp down on the number of weapons in circulation. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist. He has shared with us his views of why shootings are still a major problem or issue in the U.S.
This is a long and sad story. This recent shooting, it's tragic, as they all are, and we will soon hear the elected officials offering their thoughts and prayers to the victims. Thoughts and prayers are not enough. They need to legislate to get the guns out of the hands of so many people. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court always says that, or has stated repeatedly, that the right to bear arms trumps everything else. They forget that the right to bear arms was written into law when the U.S. had a standing militia. It didn't have a regular army as it has today. But the National Rifle Association, which is the biggest pro-gun lobby in the United States, has been very powerful for years. That power is diminishing now, but it has been very powerful for years, and has invoked a thought in people's minds that owning guns is important and is necessary, and that any attempt to restrict gun ownership at all is a major infringement on their rights. This is simply not true. It's a myth, but many people have come to believe it, and that's why we have the problems that the United States has today.
The U.S. intelligence assessment indicates that North Korea's recent missile launches could be the groundwork for a return to intercontinental ballistic missile and nuclear bomb tests for the first time in nearly 5 years. The U.S. Directorate of National Intelligence says commercial satellite imagery shows construction at North Korea's nuclear testing site that was closed in 2018. International experts also say the North's main nuclear reactor facility is in full swing, potentially creating additional fuel for nuclear weapons. North Korea tested a record number of missiles in January as part of a program to modernize its arsenal. Pyongyang insists that such tests are meant to strengthen its defense power in the face of Washington's hostile policies, sanctions, and joint military drills on the Korean Peninsula. Authorities in Sydney are ordering tens of thousands of people to leave their homes as major storms and severe floods continue to batter Australia's east coast. At least 60,000 people are subject to the evacuation orders, officials warning a tough 48 hours ahead. Floods caused by heavy downpours overnight have submerged large parts of land across Sydney. The rainfall has also flooded bridges and homes. Meanwhile, police have discovered the bodies of two people in the city, raising the death toll from the weeks-long floods in the country to 20. Over the past week, Australia's east coast has been hit with intense storms and flash floods. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
If you're black and living in Britain, you're more likely to die of COVID-19 than someone with white skin. This stark reality has been revealed by research into coronavirus pandemic health disparities, with death rates consistently higher for ethnic minorities. The issue is so serious that the UK's Department of Health and Social Care announced an independent review to find out the cause of potential bias in medical items, such as equipment that measures blood oxygen levels in different people and different ethnic groups.
Small machines that calculate the amount of oxygen in the bloodstream appear to be less accurate with non-white skin. A report by the Race Disparity Unit, part of the government's Cabinet Office, also discovered that working in roles in higher risk occupations, such as in the front line of the NHS, was another factor that may explain high infection and mortality rates in ethnic minority groups. Healthcare workers, indoor trade, and transport workers in particular were at least twice as likely to test positive for antibodies during the second wave of the pandemic when compared to people employed in other professions, while the security industry also had a significantly higher risk of infection. The outcome can be measured in infections and in deaths. Factors like the job someone does and where they live clearly impact on the risk of death from COVID-19. In addition, the colour of a person's skin creates a two-tier system whereby ethnicity literally affects a person's chances of survival if they fall ill with coronavirus. All of this has been demonstrated very clearly in objective, statistically significant research.
Why has a higher proportion of non-white men and women died of COVID-19 in the UK compared to white-skinned people? And how can it be that the instrumentation itself appears to contain some elements that discriminate against accuracy in relation to ethnic communities? Simple questions with important answers. Now, in the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, black African males were almost four times more likely to die of the disease than white males. What does the public think of this? We asked them here in central London. This is what they told us.
Ready?
Okay.
We're asking a couple of questions on these statistics in healthcare.
I didn't know this until I researched it.
On this virus that I don't believe.
Thanks very much. In the first wave of COVID-19, it turns out that people with non-white skin, and for example, black African men, were four times more likely to die than white men. What do you think about that?
Well, number one, it's very, very unfortunate. It's very sad news to be hearing. I think awareness is a key element of that. And, of course, the cultural backgrounds will play into it naturally. But, of course, awareness is the key element on that, is the key message. And protect yourselves and others.
It's not a good disparity, certainly, and we need to investigate why that's occurring. So is it genetic? Is it lifestyle? Is it, I don't know.
It's sad, but it's quite, you know, possibly genetic, you know, that people realise on looking that there was quite a lot of.
So, I don't know why. Maybe because they are not having the vaccine. It's because of, due to religious reason, that can be the reason why they are dying more than the other group.
I think they're correct. I think a lot of the BAME community, they listen to a lot of stuff on Facebook and believe that than what the government's putting out, which I can understand that side as well. So sort of like a double-edged sword type of thing.
That's kind of expected. We live in a structurally racist society. Depending on the colour of your skin, you may find that you have different opportunities in terms of housing and employment. If you look at a lot of places of employment, black people are predominantly in roles where they continued to need to come into work right through all stages of the pandemic. So they are more, they were more exposed, and they probably still are.
I think that's pretty awful, to be honest. I think that something should be definitely done about that. I don't think any minority should be at a disadvantage to anyone else.
I think it's just how we're treated, or like how men from black BAME and backgrounds are treated in, like, whenever they like go to the hospitals, and like kind of the preconceived like judgments that they have. So yeah, I'd probably be saying maybe that's what's kind of attributing to those figures.
In what sense, though? Because you can't just say your skin colour. You know, what is it? Dietary requirements? Have they been active? You know, what was gathered to get the answer? That's what I'm saying.
I think if they have got the death numbers by statistics, they are correct. And, you know, the government needs to find why the BAME are more susceptible to this disease rather than the white men, Hispanic men.
John White is a director, broadcaster and political commentator, specialising in geopolitics, political economy and issues related to class and race in British society.
Well, that became a stat that was doing the rounds in society. A lot of people jumped on what I think was the erroneous view that it's because of something innate within black people in terms of their immune system and how they were responding to the virus. I think it's more prosaic. I think it's an issue of class. I think in the UK, well, I don't think I know, in the UK, class is inextricably linked to ethnicity. Black men, Asian men, etc., ethnic minorities in total, they're more likely, they disproportionately occupy the poorest paid sectors in the workforce, in the economy, in restaurants, in distribution, in cleaners, hospital porters, NHS nurses, etc., etc. So they were more exposed to the virus.
In the second wave of the pandemic, Bangladeshi men, for example, were five times more likely to die than white males. How can this increasing disparity be occurring?
I've no idea. I mean, is there a fear of coming forward for treatment, or I don't know. It's things that we need to look at, certainly.
Maybe, well, should be something to look into as to why anybody's dying with it. But
it's not anyone doing it for that to happen. I would say it's because of people's background as well, ethnicity background. We're all brought up in a different way.
I'm not sure they're allowed to happen. I think there's ignorance, lack of analysis, lack of data. I think we now know that we could have protected those people better. I think we should have done, but without the data, without the analysis, it's very difficult to do that.
I don't know, the condition of living, I don't know, maybe the white people got more ways to survive on this virus, I don't know. But on this virus, that I don't believe.
Yeah.
Well, I think my understanding is possibly with Bangladeshi men, you might get more of an issue of poverty coming through. I think if you're just talking about people from an ethnic minority background generally, there were a lot of doctors who died.
A contributing factor could be that they tend to occupy multi-generational households, as far as I know. So transmission of the virus was greater amongst those households than it would have been in a less crowded households, fewer people living together.
So there's larger multi-generational households sometimes. If you've got small kids at school, a lot of the time I understand that's been how things have been coming back. So kids get ill at school, they don't know about it necessarily, and then it goes through closer family groups.
I would imagine that if people come in and they're from an immigrant background, that it's much harder to get support from the government. So I just think if it's a statistic that's been recorded, the government should do more about it to help that community.
I mean, it just can't be, you know, Bangladeshi, British, you know, English. There's got to be something behind the scenes. And what is it? I think that's the question.
Can our experts explain the reasons there is such an increased risk of mortality for Bangladeshi and other ethnic groups?
The government's own website reveals that 30% of all Bangladeshi and Pakistani men are in the restaurant distribution sector. So they're more exposed to the virus. And so they're on the front lines, they're key workers. And key workers absent PPE, which was the case at the start of the virus, the first lockdown, when you remember the PPE scandal, the scramble to get PPE, they were, bus drivers, etc., were sent to work without any protection, and they were dying in their droves. So I think the issue really at the bottom is class. It's not ethnic differences, it's class differences.
Dr. Bob Gill is a general practitioner and activist who has been fighting the privatisation of the NHS and has directed, produced and presented the film The Great NHS Heist, which shows just how the US insurance giants are moving in on the NHS.
But there are also the effects of social deprivation, poverty, social inequality, which, you know, will put a chronic stress on people. Now, we know chronic stress has a negative effect on the immune system, and if you have other health conditions as well as a result of deprivation and inequality and poverty, well, that's a toxic combination, a cocktail that unfortunately will have a significant impact on those who are already vulnerable. So there are issues over and above just the exposure risk.
Blood oxygen meters are less accurate for people with non-white skin. Why is medical equipment allowed to be three times more likely to overread the oxygen in the body of a person with non-white skin in comparison to the accuracy achieved with those who do have white skin?
I've no idea, but definitely that's, you know, now that they do know, how much effort is going into making those meters more applicable to all colours of skin.
It's to do with the way it works. It sort of shines through the skin. So it doesn't work with nail varnish on the fingers because they, I can't remember what it is. It's red light don't get through.
Infrared
light don't get through proper. So, yeah, if it's darker skin, it is going to cause a problem, yeah.
Do you think we should be able to fix this?
Hopefully, yes, yes. We should be able to, you know, it should work on everybody's skin, whatever colour they are.
I've never heard about that one, so it's new. I'm not quite sure why it's not reading on black skin.
Because they haven't been tested across a proper range of the population, and it's to do with the trials of how things are tested. I think you sometimes see similar disparities where drugs companies are unwilling to test drugs on young women. After the thalidomide scandal, they're always worried about pregnancy, so you've seen similar issues there.
If you look at Google, Google reflects society's prejudices, so there's great examples where if you search for unprofessional hair, all Google returns is images of people with black braided hairstyles. That's not unprofessional, it's just basically what our society suggests in lots of documents, and that's what gets fed back to us. Getting the wrong readings on a blood oximeter is the same thing, it's negative feedback from structural racism.
I assume they've probably been built and tested on people who are from a white background. Again, I think in this day and age, probably need to update that quite drastically, because that's just not... It's not fair and it's not an accurate representation of the community anymore.
I don't think that they're updating the kind of medical equipment that they need regularly. So I think these pulse oximeters have been made like from years back, and they're still using those same instruments. And yeah, it just needs to kind of be updated with recent figures to kind of counter all of that in, so that it isn't like inaccurate when it's coming up or when the results are coming out. Yeah.
Well, that's scandalous. I mean, that's something that definitely has to be looked at, and yeah, that could lead to, well, it's already led to, I'm assuming, negative or bad results. So yeah, I mean, it's not good.
What has led to a system where the very equipment used to measure blood oxygen levels gives such wrong readings for those with non-white skin? Here are the views of our experts.
It's unfortunate that the pulse oximeters haven't been adjusted to take account for the falsely, you know, good readings that they can sometimes show. And it's down to the design, the use of infrared light to estimate blood oxygen levels. And if you have pigmented skin, then you will get a false reading. But they should, to mitigate that, you know, in the short term, people should have been sent guidelines. Health professionals should have been informed that, you know, don't ignore clinical judgment. You may need to reduce down in, you know, allow for 5 to 10% overreading in the oximeter and take that into account. So you might have a patient who looks unwell, but the oximeter is reassuring. Well, if there was widespread knowledge of the false readings, then maybe that would have helped.
In the first wave of the pandemic, the rate of death from COVID-19 for black African males was 3.7 times greater than for white British males, and 2.6 times greater for females. For the Bangladeshi community, it was 3 times higher for males and 1.9 times higher for females. However, in the second wave, starting in September 2020, the differences in COVID-19 mortality for Bangladeshi and Pakistani ethnic backgrounds was even worse. The Bangladeshi group had the highest rate, 5 times higher for men and 4.1 times higher for women versus the white equivalent statistics.
Some of the differences in mortality rates could be explained by the fact that ethnic communities tend to work in higher risk occupations like healthcare, indoor trade and transport. So in that context, are they getting proportionate and fair treatment when it comes to COVID-19?
Well, I only can comment on my own environment there. And there, yes, there is plenty of information, plenty of opportunity, plenty of impetus and attention being paid to it, yes.
Definitely. I mean, now that we're fully aware and we've got all of these statistics that indicate these people are at more risk, then we should be doing more.
It's where I come from in Leeds. It's quite a deprived area and the schools aren't that great, so the sort of moving on to university is not as high as you in sort of other areas.
There's been a lot of encouragement and maybe it's just cultural and the beliefs are not sure, the different areas and that we're not, you know, don't understand exactly.
Just, it's rather unfortunate that's happening because we are, most of us are the one doing the hard work, I would say. So, but well, this is the country we live in, so we just need to continue the work we can do to help the country.
This country is for white people country, and people come from abroad, and they do whatever we do whatever is available to do.
It isn't, but I don't know what you can do about it when the pandemic's just started. You can't immediately rearrange people's jobs. I don't really know what to say about that.
Is it fair or is it not? These people have to work. They have to earn a living. And I think measures have been put in place because of the high incidence of, or the risk factor for these people.
It's not. Definitely, it's not fair anyway, whether it's during a pandemic or not. I think it just comes to light in a pandemic and that's where it gets highlighted, unfortunately. But hopefully, with all of this data that you've kind of talked me through, hopefully people can take that on board and do something about it.
It depends what you mean by fairness, because obviously this country has quite a large proportion of ethnic minority groups, more so now than we ever have had. So I'm not surprised that the figures relating to those jobs have gone up much higher.
So, with greater risk occupations and racial bias in blood oxygen meters, how well has the government served ethnic communities, many of whom have been in the front line in saving the lives of others while putting themselves at risk?
Do you think the government's given, with all these problems, given enough attention to ethnic communities or us generally in terms of COVID?
No. Really? I think the government, I would say the government is trying, but I think he left things too late. Make decision very late for us to get into this stage. I think if things was done earlier, a lot of things could have been avoided, I would say.
Do you think the government really has served ethnic communities in this country effectively over the last 2 years when it comes to COVID?
No, is the short answer.
Not very well, I don't think. It's been very inconsistent. The advice and the information that we've been given has been quite contradictory. One day we've got this and one day we've got that.
So I don't think it's done well. Again, I think there's a lack of data. What they need to do now is, frankly, get their arse in motion, if you excuse me saying so, and make sure this doesn't happen again, and that we now really look at these issues and really address them properly so that our ethnic communities from all different backgrounds feel more looked after and more that we research it more carefully and that we have the real data to make sure they're we are all equally privileged in this society.
Not well at all. Not well at all. I don't know that they could do anything before they had the answers. Like, when it hit, it just hit. And then you look back and there are obviously massive issues. But I think at the time when it hit, I don't know that there was much they could do about it. And then, and they're short of healthcare workers, so it wasn't that there was a great pool of untapped white healthcare workers who could be drafted in when the pandemic hit.
I mean, I don't know a lot about the exact government policy that's out there at the moment, but what I do know and think now is that they should improve drastically and they should take action immediately to rectify that situation.
I don't think the government's done much, I'll be honest. I feel like they could have done a lot more to kind of, you know, really back the NHS and really, show that, you know, they're acting in the best interest of, like, medical staff and medical assistants. And
I think if there's something that's been discovered or perhaps, you know, that needs to be looked at further, I think the government in general, you know, whether it's healthcare, policing, you know, in general, it's just too slow. I think that's something the government needs to just, you know, it's been really bad during the COVID, and COVID has been used as a mask to make things slower, I think, and worse.
We gave our experts the chance to comment on the extent to which they believe the government has served those from ethnic communities who are literally the frontline team, saving others from coronavirus while risking their own lives in the process.
Well, the government's handling of the pandemic for the whole population has been very bad compared to other countries. They failed to take mitigation. The advice was very confusing. We were getting mixed signals. Now, that had a greater impact on ethnic minorities because of the risks that we've discussed, greater exposure and the higher incidence of chronic illness. So I don't believe the government particularly were negligent towards the ethnic minorities. They were negligent to the whole population. I think this is more of a problem of class, working class and people at the bottom of society being ignored. Their needs ignored, and we haven't had the investment in public health measures. We haven't had the capacity build up we needed in our health service, and that's affected the whole population, but it's taken a greater toll on ethnic minorities.
Research reveals measuring equipment overestimated oxygen saturation 3.6% of the time in white patients, but for black patients, it overestimated it 12% of the time. This means a built-in racial bias in medical equipment, which very likely has contributed to increased risks of serious illness and death in non-white patients suffering acute effects from COVID-19.
The harsh reality is that members of ethnic communities are much more at risk from COVID-19 in the UK than people who are white, with discrimination built into the medical equipment and the dangers associated with frontline roles. All of this means that if you're not white, you're more likely to die during a pandemic that currently shows no signs of going away any more than that built-in ethnic bias. That's the lethal cost of being black and living in Britain during COVID-19.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Allah, Allah.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
اعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi assalam. Justice is a needed concept for humanity, is a needed concept to be applied in a society. And one of the main elements of justice is the fact that people need to have their freedom. We said in a previous episode that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam believed firmly that people need to be free. Freedom is the result of the mutual relations, sentiments, and inclinations of the people. It has a close relationship with a few things which exercise a great influence on it. Now, reason and experience prove that this concept, and it has been confirmed by the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, that the members of society are interrelated with one another. So when we speak about the concept of freedom, obviously if I'm by my own, I'm free to do wherever I want. But when I am in a society, then my freedom takes a different shape. So me and you living together, we have an interrelated interests when it comes to dealing with one another, because we are a society nevertheless. This interrelationship of theirs is on account of personal interests as well as national interests. So when I am interrelated to you, sometimes I have personal interests that I want from you. So you could be a doctor, I could be a baker. I take from you, you give to me. So we exercise a freedom of right between us. And also, this interrelationship also has to serve the public order. It has to sell. It has to serve the national interest. It was the policy of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam to reform these relations and ties so that every person might lead his life in a better way. So it was not left to people to do as they like, to say, I am free, therefore I can do as I wish. No, because obviously there are limitations when it comes to freedom. My freedom stops when it becomes a violation of the rights of others. So Amir al-Mu'mineen wanted to mend, reform these relationships. He wanted to connect and reconnect this relationship once again based on the fact that people are doing the correct and right thing. He provided opportunities to the people to utilize their freedom in the best possible manner and to discharge by means of this freedom the responsibilities which is not possible to discharge without it. So you can see there's a lot at play that Amir al-Mu'mineen had to reform when it came to freedom and the freedom of people. Now, before we continue, let us take a short break and we will come back right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. In the first instant, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah made the people realize that to establish truth and destroy falsehood and establish freedom of people, that this would not happen if people themselves do not take it as their own responsibility. It is not the responsibility of the ruler to come and enforce things on them. It is not the responsibility of the government to force people to be righteous, to be good doers, to go and establish the truth and destroy falsehood. Rather, it is the responsibility of the individuals, the responsibility of the subjects themselves, the citizens. It is mine and yours. We have to establish it. And Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi wanted that people should get hold of their freedom first, to ensure and to make sure they can apply such concept of truth and to avoid and stay away from falsehood. So they should get hold of their freedom, should not be subservient to the orders of the upper class, and should neither betray the society nor be cruel to themselves. So we have a lot of things at play here when it comes in terms of establishing freedom of the people so they could carry out their responsibilities. Throughout his life, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, and even before he attained the Khilafah, the Caliphates and the power and rulership, as well as thereafter, he explained to the people that they must discharge their duty to establish right and destroy falsehood. So he constantly preached and taught people that it is their own responsibility to establish truth and justice between themselves, first and foremost, and then towards their leaders and towards their governors or what have you. It is a responsibility of the people themselves that they need to learn and educate themselves. So you can see Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, whether in his sermons or in his sayings or in his conduct, he constantly was trying to explain to the people, educate the people, that they must themselves take hold of their own freedom in order to establish these notions, these concepts. When there are rulers and leaders and governors into play who are oppressing people, Amir al-Mu'mineen used to command them. He used to tell them, you should rise up. You should exercise your right. But because people's freedom was taken away from them, there was only little they could do. Having said that, Amir al-Mu'mineen did not see that as an excuse for people to remain silent and to let their rights go away. So he wanted to enforce that the fact that people need to have the freedom in order for them to establish truth and fight falsehood. We'll leave it here and we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website,
is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.